Good evening and welcome to the KRFP Evening Report for Monday, November 13th, 2023. I'm Lee Robartis in the news tonight. Rift between Idaho conservatives and far right in legislature widens as Senator Pro Tem Chuck Winder removes Senator Zwiederveld from Vice Chair of Health and Welfare Committee over comments she made about the influence of the Idaho Association of Commerce and Industry, Idaho's largest lobbyist organization. Lisa Brown and liberals win in Spokane elections, but voters pass hard-to-enforce Republican-backed camping ban as homelessness remains a hot-button issue. And federal judge hears arguments in lawsuit over Idaho law making gender-affirming care for minors a felony. We'll have details on those stories and more coming up on the KRFP Evening Report. And live in the KRFP studios in Moscow, Idaho, I'm Lee Robartis, and this is the KRFP Evening Report. Crews working with Avista have restored methane heat to Moscow City buildings, including City Hall and the Hamilton Indoor Recreation Center. A news release from the city says the community can use the Hamilton Indoor Recreation Center as a warming center weekdays between 8 a.m. and 10 p.m., and the public can use shower facilities there. The Moscow Public Library is also open with heat. The city of Pullman has announced Avista crews restored methane gas to their buildings last night. That includes City Hall, Neal Public Library, and the Pullman Recreation Center. The Pullman Aquatic and Fitness Center will stay closed until the pool reheats. Avista has announced yesterday its relighting of methane appliances on the Palouse, and the Lewiston-Clarkston Valley is still on schedule to be completed by tomorrow evening. If people were not at home or in a business when Avista team stopped by to turn on gas pilots, they will leave a doorknob hanger and people can call Avista throughout the week to have their gas turned on. Avista Utilities said in a press release late Saturday afternoon they expect workers to complete the relighting process for the 37,000 methane customers around the region by Tuesday evening. The company says 800 employees and contractors are going door to door on the Palouse in the Lewiston-Clarkston Valley, relighting methane appliances, working from 6 a.m. till 10 p.m. The press release said teams of two workers are averaging more than four relights per hour, and they peaked at 900 relights in an hour. Natural gas service went down throughout the region Wednesday when a landowner's plow punctured an underground distribution line owned by Williams Companies about 4 miles north of Pullman near U.S. Highway 195. The company completed repairing the line Thursday afternoon, but all the methane appliances in the region need to be relit. Strong winds in the region cut power to 850 customers in eastern Washington and northern Idaho Saturday afternoon. Power was restored to about half of those customers by early Saturday evening. Avista reported 29 customers were without power on the Palouse due to the wind Saturday afternoon. The highest wind gusts in the region Saturday afternoon were a 53-mile-per-hour gust at Deer Park Airport and a 52-mile-per-hour gust at Spokane International Airport. Idaho Senate Pro Tem Chuck Winder has removed freshman Republican Senator Glenita Zwiederveld of Twin Falls from her position as vice chair of the Senate Health and Welfare Committee over her public criticism of state lawmakers affiliated with Idaho's largest lobbying organization, the Idaho Association of Commerce and Industry. In a social media post, Zwiederveld quoted the Idaho Association of Commerce and Industry's website, which says the lobby supports candidates, quote, who demonstrate commitment to the ideals of a free market society, who believe in the rights of the individual, and who are committed to preserving the free enterprise system. According to the Idaho Press, Zwiederveld wrote, in their own words, they state they determine which candidates will receive their support based on who demonstrates a commitment to their ideals. Deals and the free market, in other words, who will carry out their agenda. One must question their definition of a free market. Zwiederveld also posted the IACI's endorsements of 35 Republican legislators. Senator Pro Tem Winder wrote on November 6th, In a letter to Zwiederveld, she had posted an article which, quote, openly attacked the integrity of your fellow members of the Idaho Senate. He wrote he has a duty to protect the integrity of the legislative process and members of the Senate, and, quote, when such integrity is threatened, I may exercise my authority to remove chairs and vice chairs who fail to conduct themselves in a manner expected of an elected official. As such, I have decided to immediately remove you as vice chair of the Health and Welfare Committee. You will only be allowed to serve as a member of the committee. Winder also called on Republican Senator Scott Herndon of Sagal to apologize to every Senate member on the Joint Finance Appropriations Committee for what he called his personal attacks on them. Herndon is a member of the powerful Budget Writing Committee. Herndon complained the Senate did not kill any of the budget bills that came out of the committee and returned them for rewrites. He wrote, out of 110 budget bills, some of them are probably still bad when they get to the Senate or the House floors, and they should be voted down and sent back to JFAC for some more work. Winder wrote Herndon's post was degrading and disparaging to every senator on JFAC. He wrote, members of JFAC are tasked with setting the budget for the entire state, which requires countless hours of reviewing, analyzing, and thoughtfully considering budgetary bills. Your statements are unnecessary and inexcusable. He said he asked JFAC staff about Herndon's work and found he only worked on one small budget in his time on the committee. Herndon updated his original post to say he worked on five budgets, but Herndon and Zwiederveld are part of the Idaho Freedom Caucus, which is the extreme right's presence in the legislature. The lobbying groups, the Idaho Freedom Foundation and Idaho Family Policy Center, are vying for power in the legislature and are affiliated with the Idaho Freedom Caucus. Herndon emailed a press release from the Idaho Freedom Caucus in which he wrote of Winder, "This is a direct attack by one senator to erode our ability to serve the people of Idaho who elected us. Our duty is to inform and give voice to the people of our districts, not to amplify the views of Senator Winder. His hostile comments, which are factually inaccurate, are degrading and disparaging." Herndon is reportedly working on a bill to remove rape and incest exceptions from Idaho's strict anti-abortion laws. Zwiederveld wrote in a press release, "Regardless of what actions the leadership takes, I do not work for them. I work for the people. I will not allow intimidation to silence me." Herndon and Zwiederveld and other members of the Idaho Freedom Caucus voted against many of the budget bills in the Joint Finance Appropriations Committee, such as the Department of Fish and Game's budget, the Office of the Secretary of State's budget, the Department of Land's budget, the Department of Juvenile Corrections budget, and the Office of the State Treasurer budget. They voted for other bills, many of which had unanimous or near unanimous support, such as for the Department of Correction and the Military Division. And you're tuned in to the KRFP Evening Report. This is KRFP Moscow Pullman.
A federal judge has temporarily blocked an anti-abortion law in Idaho that restricted people's ability to travel to other states for the procedure. During the 2023 legislative session, state lawmakers passed a law restricting abortion trafficking, which it describes as an adult bringing a child across state lines for an abortion with the intent to conceal it from the child's parents or guardians. However, Kelly O'Neill, Idaho litigation attorney with Legal Voice, says a U.S. District Court judge agreed to their preliminary injunction request, blocking the law while the case is decided.
The judge agreed that the law is unconstitutional and that it violates First Amendment freedoms, the right to interstate travel, and that it's unconstitutionally vague, and that it's confusing that a person can't determine what conduct is legal and what might land you in prison for a minimum of 2 years.
Idaho has some of the most restrictive abortion laws in the country, with the procedure banned in nearly every instance. While abortions have decreased in the state, research shows they've increased in neighboring states where it's protected since Roe v. Wade was overturned, such as in Washington. O'Neill notes that Idaho is not the only state where lawmakers are attempting to restrict abortion.
There's a huge wave of anti-abortion laws coming out of Idaho in particular and every state in the nation, and people are working and doing their part to try to push back against those and restore options of choices and freedom. And this is certainly a way that we're helping to do that.
Defendants in the case filed suit, challenging the Idaho law in July. The parties involved gave oral arguments in September. For Northern Rockies News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Federal Judge B. Lynn Windmill in Boise said last week he must consider the right to privacy and parental rights when deciding a lawsuit calling for a preliminary injunction against Idaho's new law, which makes it a felony for a doctor to give gender-affirming care to a minor. Judge Windmill heard arguments in the American Civil Liberties Union motion for a preliminary injunction against House Bill 71, which Governor Brad Little signed in April. ACLU attorney Lee Nowlin Soule is representing parents of transgender children, Rest Collective, the ACLU of Idaho, and others. ACLU attorney Nowlin Soule said the law is unconstitutional because it undermines parents' rights. According to an account of the court proceedings in the Idaho Capital Sun, Nowlin Soule said, "It is parents, not legislators, that should decide whether the treatment is wrong for their children." She said the law violates the right to equal protection because it discriminates based on transgender status and sex. Nowlin Soule said the law requires different treatments for transgender persons because hormone therapy can be used to treat cisgender patients with certain health conditions such as polycystic ovary syndrome, but it prevents the same treatments being used on transgender minors with gender dysphoria. She said the medical community has widely accepted the guidelines for treating gender dysphoria from the World Professional Association for Transgender Health. Nowlin Soule also criticized the insistence by Idaho lawmakers who do not have medical expertise that psychotherapy can solve gender dysphoria. She argued in court, "This speculation is not evidence. The state is taking away the only evidence-based treatment for gender dysphoria, which doesn't protect children but harms them." Special Deputy Attorney General John Raymer, who works for the Washington, D.C. law firm Cooper & Kirk, argued the health risks of gender-affirming care outweigh the benefits. Raymer said psychotherapy is less risky. He said psychotherapy could provide the same benefits and the risk is vastly different in terms of the harm a patient would experience. 16-year-old transgender youth Jane Doe of Idaho said in a press release, "It's shocking to have politicians take those decisions away from us. Trans people like myself deserve the same chance at safety and liberty as everyone else, but this law specifically targets us and our health care for no good reason. I'm 16. I should be hanging out with my friends and planning my future instead of fighting my state for the health care I need." The largest school bonds on the ballot last week in Idaho lost. Pocatello-Chubbuck School District had a $45 million bond on the ballot, which would have enhanced the district's two high schools, one of which was heavily damaged by a fire in the spring. 56% of the voters supported the bond, but in Idaho, bonds need a two-thirds supermajority to pass. There was unprecedented voter turnout in the Shelley School District, which struck down a $67.8 million bond with 48% voting in favor. Levies passed last week in Nampa, Kellogg, Minidoka, Wallace, Middleton, Salmon, Filer, North Gem, Kimberly, and Westside School District in Franklin County. Levies failed in Mountain View and Basin. Most of the votes are in, and candidate Lisa Brown has won the race for Spokane mayor with 51.9% of the vote, ousting incumbent mayor Nadine Woodward. Brown was former Democratic leader in the Washington State Senate and more recently Commerce Secretary before she resigned to run for mayor. Woodward has been associated with Republican power brokers in Spokane. The Liberal Betsy Wilkerson won the citywide race for city council president over conservative Kim Pleasey. City elections are nonpartisan in Washington, but there were clear lines between liberal and conservative candidates in all of the Spokane City races. Liberals won in two of the three races for city council seats up for election this year. Paul Dillon took 53% of the vote over Katie Trelawar in District 2, which is the southern part of the city, and Kitty Kilski won with 59.5% of the vote over Earl Moore in District 3 in the northeastern part of the city. In the more conservative district, which is the northwest part of the city, conservative Michael Cathcart won re-election with 56% of the vote against Lindsay Shaw. There has been some discussion over the mixed message from voters because voters in the city overwhelmingly voted to pass the camping ban, which would ban homeless people from camping in two-thirds of the city, basically anywhere within 1,000 feet of a school, playground, or daycare. One map that an Eastern Washington University anthropology professor produced before the election showed camping would be illegal in almost all of downtown. Camping is already illegal on public property in Spokane, but under the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals decision in Martin versus the City of Boise, police can only issue citations if there are shelter beds available, and most of the time in Spokane, there are not. The Liberals, who won city races from mayor on down, were not in favor of the new ordinance. Police Chief Craig Meidel says the police have not had the staffing to respond to the hundreds of homeless camping complaints they received under the previous law. It's unclear whether Spokane's new law violates the Martin versus Boise ruling, which says cities cannot ban camping everywhere if there are no available shelter beds. Jules Helping Hands, a Spokane homeless advocacy group, plans to sue, citing Martin versus Boise. Regarding the divergent election results, City Council member-elect Paul Dillon said the conservative-backed anti-camping ordinance was never intended to address voters' concerns about homelessness. Dillon told the Spokesman Review, "I think the language in the initiative was deceptive. It was absolutely a right-wing ploy, a get-out-the-vote opportunity. We don't have the resources to enforce this, and it will just push people around." Michael Cathcart, the conservative who won re-election to the city council seat, sees it differently. Cathcart said, "The voters seem to see it as a protection, so I am free to elect a politician that supports other issues I care about, even if they disagree with me on this one." Mayor-elect Lisa Brown said, "What we have not had in the last 4 years is a clearly articulated plan with some common ground view on how to address the crisis. The candidates opposed to the proposition weren't opposed to addressing unhoused people. It was a question of how to do it, and the sense that simply saying you can't be here would not address it." You're listening to the KRFP Evening Report.
Washington State's Climate Commitment Act promised funds for communities on the front lines of climate change. One group is tracking those dollars to make sure the state follows through. Passed in 2021, the CCA is the state's carbon cap and trade program, with at least 35% of the revenue it generates committed to vulnerable populations within overburdened communities. However, an analysis by the nonprofit Front and Centered found less than 7% of revenue in the current budget met this requirement. Guillermo Rahel with Front and Centered says the group is looking at the state's investment in areas like transportation.
Some communities are able to afford increased access to public transit, some are not, and that's what CCA investments could be used for. So it's just an example of what we want to see.
Rahel notes it's still early in the process of distributing funds from the CCA. Revenue generated by the program has reached nearly $1.5 billion so far in its first year of carbon auctions. Rahel says the 2024 legislative session should give lawmakers an opportunity to ensure frontline communities are prioritized.
We'll be asking the legislature to take a look at their budget, see what in their budget is explicitly dedicated to overburdened communities, where we can be a little bit more clear, and where we can really make sure that the intent and the spirit of bills like the HEAL Act and the environmental justice provisions of the CCA are met.
Also passed in 2021, the HEAL, or Healthy Environment for All Act, aims to ensure communities affected the most by climate change are prioritized as well. It requires seven state agencies to direct 40% of their grants and expenditures to these communities. For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
The Wyoming Game and Fish Department is moving forward with the sublet pronghorn migration corridor designation process. Josh Metten with the Theodore Roosevelt Conservation Partnership says the move is an important step to protect key spots along the iconic route between Rock Springs and Grand Teton National Park. That includes places where animals get corralled and funneled into bottlenecks and places herds recover from winter by hunkering down to feed on green up vegetation.
That's really important for the whole herd, but especially females that are getting ready to have their fawns. So making sure that there's appropriate management of development in these high priority areas like stopovers and bottlenecks.
A recent threat evaluation released by Game and Fish found that the corridor is at high risk of being lost due to human activity. In just the past 3 years, high priority areas saw developments, including a 3,500 well gas field, a state gas auction leasing 640 acres for $19 an acre within a known bottleneck, and more subdivisions, according to Wildfile. Metten believes protecting the corridor is not an either-or proposition. Thanks to advanced GPS collar data tracking herd movements, he says all stakeholders can sit down at the same table and find ways to accommodate multiple uses of adjacent lands, including energy production, housing development, and increased access to outdoor recreation.
These are all things that we can still have on the landscape if we do it right, using a science-based approach to identify what's the most important areas to conserve, and we set appropriate limits in areas that are needed.
Public meetings are set for this Thursday in Pinedale, November 29th in Green River, and November 30th in Jackson. The agency will accept public comments through January 5th. Metten says enjoying wildlife like the sublet pronghorn herd is a big reason why hardworking families are proud to call Wyoming home.
We're thankful to Governor Gordon and the staff at Wyoming Game and Fish Department for their commitment to ensuring that this irreplaceable wildlife resource is sustained into the future.
This is Eric Galatis for the Wyoming News Service.
November is National Family Caregivers Month, and a few tips can help people with their duties. Head of the Oregon organization Aging Concerns, Vicki Schmall, says family caregivers often are called the backbone of long-term care. But she says people performing these roles must remember to think about themselves as well.
I often say to family caregivers, taking care of yourself is really the best gift you can give to the person who needs your care.
Schmall says it's critical that they be willing to ask for and accept help. She says there are local supports available for caregivers through programs such as Oregon Care Partners and the state's Aging and Disability Resource Connection. Schmall says people also should do their research early about potential facilities in the event in-home care becomes too much. She points to the service Elder Care Locator as a helpful resource in this search.
What is most important about decision-making is making decisions based on what is best, and not on promises I made earlier or feelings of guilt, and also not on pressures from others.
Schmall emphasizes that caregivers need to pay attention to how they're doing.
If as a caregiver you find yourself becoming socially isolated, it's a warning sign. It says the importance of making some change, because social isolation is not good for either the family caregiver or the person receiving care.
For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
The Extinction Rebellion protest in Moscow's Friendship Square was planned before the Williams methane transmission line ruptured north of Pullman Wednesday, and the group had already planned to focus on the ongoing efforts to expand the GTN Express natural gas pipeline, bringing in fracked gas from Canada through the Idaho Panhandle, Spokane County, western Whitman County, Walla Walla County, and down through Oregon to California. The methane situation on the Palouse and in the LC Valley provided an opportunity for Extinction Rebellion activists to point out the fragility of natural gas infrastructure and the potential for localized toxic pollution. Here's Helen Yost and Cass Davis speaking at Friday's rally in downtown Moscow.
How come we all can't take showers this week?
Gas.
How reliable is fossil fuels infrastructure, right?
Woo.
But no, the same company that tried to push through the Keystone XL pipeline and that owns the Keystone pipeline that just burst 600,000 gallons of tar sands into Kansas, and that owns the Columbia system in the Northeast that ruptured and had a fiery explosion not far from Washington, D.C., not to mention that also is constructing the Coastal GasLink gas pipeline across the to shove extra unneeded gas through the Gas Transmission Northwest or GTN pipeline across North Idaho, Eastern Washington, and Central Oregon. This goes against all the climate laws in Oregon and Washington that have promised to cut back to zero carbon emissions within the next 20 years. It also brings gas into the Northwest that would be one of the largest sources of climate pollution in the next 30 years of this expansion project. So we don't need this gas, and we don't want this gas. It wrecks human health, like all the toxic gases that come off of compressor stations. The ones they want to upgrade are in Athol, Idaho, in Starbuck near Walla Walla in Washington, and in Kent near Bend, Oregon. That means more toxic fumes for those pipeline corridor communities. And, you know, that risks their health. It decreases their lifespan, and it, for all of us, it's more carbon pollution, more wildfires, more floods. For instance, in Athol, back on August 15th, there was a wildfire, only 60 acres, but it broke out only a half a mile from this pipeline, and only 1 3/4 mile away from the very compressor station that they want to upgrade. And, you know, there's been four pipeline explosion or leak incidents since that time, one in Sandpoint in a residential area only a mile from this pipeline expansion, one down in Middleton, Idaho, which caused the entire town of 10,000 people to be evacuated, and people could hear the gas rushing out of that pipeline from a mile away. They said it sounded like a jet engine or a train wreck. Then, of course, there was one in Bend around the same time that this pollution leak happened. It was just a little residential leak. But now, you know, all of us are without gas. We're without hot water. People are having to, you know, figure out other ways to heat their homes and bathe. And all because another gas pipeline ruptured right here on the Palouse. And it just goes to show that this infrastructure is really unreliable besides causing climate change.
In Oregon and Washington, most of their legislative body has spoken out against this project. In Idaho, they roll out the red carpet. The attorneys generals of both states are very concerned with this pipeline. In Idaho, they will probably fight for it. So FERC, the Federal Energy Regulation Commission, FERC, okayed this back on October 19th. And there still are some appeals that will be tried, but we don't know. We just don't know. And at this time, we're gearing up for a direct action campaign that will be strung out over a couple of years. And hopefully we can stop this project because we don't need more fossil fuels at this point. And by the way, these fossil fuels, as Helen said, are coming down from Canada. They're on fracked Native American land. People die of poison. Their water gets polluted. And don't kid yourself, it's not natural gas. It's methane. And methane is one of the worst as far as greenhouse gases go.
According to a handout from Wild Idaho Rising Tide, the GTN Express pipeline expansion would cause more than 3.47 million metric tons in annual greenhouse gas emissions, equivalent to 754,000 additional passenger vehicles per year until 2052, or several new gas-fired power plants, and more than the annual emissions from all of the methane-using commercial buildings in the state of Washington. Well, that's it for the KRFB Evening Report for tonight. Taking a look at the weather from the National Weather Service. They're saying 10% chance of rain after 4 a.m. Mostly cloudy with a low of 33. Patchy fog after 7 p.m. tonight. 20% chance of rain before 10 a.m. tomorrow. Snow level 4,000 feet, rising to 4,800 feet in the afternoon. Cloudy through mid-morning, then gradual clearing, high 49. Patchy fog before 7 a.m. Tuesday night, 60% chance of rain, mainly after 4 a.m. Increasing clouds, low 35. And on Wednesday, 80% chance of rain, between a quarter and a half inch of rain possible. Snow level 5,600 feet, lowering to 4,800 feet in the afternoon, high 45. Currently, we have 41 degrees. If you want to help KRFP keep newscasts like this on the air, plus the newscasts you hear during Morning Mix, the recordings of local events, and the public affairs shows, plus the music and arts programming you hear every day on KRFP, be sure to become a member of KRFP. Memberships are $35 a year, $20 for students and low income. You can mail your memberships to KRFP, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. You can also go to the KRFP website to find out more ways to help KRFP. There's a drop-down box that says Support KRFP. You can underwrite programming, which is a cost-effective way of letting our listeners know your business supports community radio. You can also adopt a DJ. There's a PayPal option and a Patreon button. Also on the website, you can stream KRFP and listen to archived editions of all the KRFP shows in the last 2 weeks. Once again, we'll gladly accept checks of any amount at KRFP, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. I'm Lee Robardis. Have a good night. Coming up next, Flashpoints, the Daily Investigative News Magazine, and music begins at 7:30 with Zach Dunoir on the air, and Chia Pets on 9 to 11 to play music for you, and then 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. we have syndicated world music with the Motherland Influence, so stay tuned. KRFP, Moscow Pullman.
Programming on KRFP is sponsored in part by Hunga Dunga Brewing Company of 333 North Jackson Street in Moscow. Hunga Dunga features live music, special events, fine food, and craft beers at hungadungabrewing.com and on Facebook and Instagram. KRFP programming is also sponsored by
Mikey's Euros, specializing in Greek and Middle Eastern cuisine, such as Euros, falafel, hummus, and tabbouleh, located at 527 South Main Street in Moscow.